And welcome back to the Bicycle Indiana podcast, Life Behind Bars. Margaret B. here with a new episode and a new background music. If you haven't noticed or listened, it's definitely hopefully going to hint to what the discussion is going to be about. And for all the IU fans or non-IU fans out there, sing along as you listen to me introduce our next discussion, our next person. And I hope you really enjoy this discussion. And again, please visit our website, www.bicycleindiana.org. Follow us on social media. Become a member. That's what helps us keep rolling and doing the things that we do. So I'm super excited about this discussion, and I hope you enjoy it as well. And welcome back and good morning to Bicycle Indiana's podcast, Life Behind Bars. Today, I have somebody really awesome on the call to talk about some really great cycling history, but also a really great event that happens down in Bloomington. And I'm talking about student involvement at IU Bloomington. So please welcome Emily Carrico from IU Bloomington. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Do you want to take a moment to kind of introduce yourself and your role and what you do?
Absolutely. So I'm Emily Carrico. I am really lucky to be able to say I'm the Little 500 race director. So I've been in this role for two Little 500 races, and the 2025 race will be my third. It's a role that I kind of just fell into. I'm actually a dietitian, so my background is not, in event planning or anything like that, but I really do have the best job, and it's so rewarding getting to work with our students and, you know, put on this fantastic race and just continue this great tradition.
Yeah, I'm just really excited to talk about this with you because one, it's on my bucket list to come visit, but also it's just a really great part of Indiana's history and the sport. And obviously, I love talking about bikes and community, right? So let's just kind of like really dive into the first big question I wrote down is for all of our listeners that aren't aware of this big event, because when I moved here, I unfortunately did not know what the Little 500 was. And people looked at me like I was crazy. And I thought, I'm from Detroit. Like, I don't know what Little 500 is. But what is the Little 500 race? Like, what is it?
Wow, that's a great question. So the Little 500 has been around for almost 75 years now. We have our 74th running of the men's race coming up this spring. It is based off of the Indy 500, so that's where we get our name. And it started off way back in 1951 as a bike race for students to help raise scholarship money for working students on campus. So its roots are really in philanthropy and being part of the IU Foundation, the IU Student Foundation. That is really just one of the core principles of this race. But it is so unique. You will not find another race like this. It's one of the things that makes it so special. So we have a facility that is a cinder track. And for our women's race, they race 100 laps around that, roughly 25 miles. And for the men's, it is 200 laps, roughly 50 miles, and they are on single speed coaster brake bikes. So it's a big relay race. And it is just the most exciting event. The energy in the stadium is just fantastic. And, you know, in terms of spectators, we have thousands of people in the stadium each year.
Yeah.
So none of our riders are getting paid. They're not doing athletes, but trust me, some of them really train like it. And that's one of the things that makes it so cool.
Definitely. And I see a lot of the athletes that race Little 500 on sometimes elite teams or other teams that are outside of IU, and they get kind of discovered from racing Little 500, which is really cool too.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of our riders, you know, the vast majority of them, they are not cyclists before they join the Little 500 community.
Sure.
We do our best to make it very approachable and, you know, just lower those barriers of entry to cycling, which we know can be an expensive sport, also a sport that has just a lot of learning curves. So, yeah, we just try to make sure that we can support all of our riders. We have about 450 right now, which is fantastic. And that looks like helping them get comfortable on the track. We do some road rides, but really they're able to build this whole community, you know, within themselves and their teams outside sure. the IU Student Foundation.
So 75 years, that's a lot of time and races and excitement in the area. But can you kind of describe to our listeners, I guess I'll first start off with who can race, and then how do you start a team?
That's a great question. So the Little 500 is an intramural competition for undergraduates at IU. Graduate students cannot participate, and if a student isn't actively enrolled at IU Bloomington, they are unable to participate. So it really is meant to be that intramural competition. We don't allow professional cyclists to come in, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. There's history on that. We have a whole 60-page manual.
Wow.
Rules and regulations of the race. It's fascinating. I could go so in depth on some of our rules and why they exist.
Well, that's on my list in a little bit. So
fantastic. Okay. So the students find teams in a whole variety of ways. So some of them come onto campus and they join Greek Life, and then they're racing for their fraternity or sorority.
Okay.
Another avenue that used to be probably the largest was all of our dorm teams. And as you know, students no longer live in dorms for as long as they did, we've seen those teams really shrink and independent teams really grow. So independent teams generally don't have any affiliation with, you know, another organization. Some of them do, but most of the time it's just some friends who are like, hey, let's get together and, you know, form a bike team. So we try to keep it, like I said, really low barrier to entry in order to form a Little 500 team or compete. You know, you pay $100 for the race entry, and then you put down a $500 deposit for the bikes, which if you turn the bikes in at the end of the semester, we'll give you your $500 back. So really we try to, like I said, just keep it really, really low barrier to entry, and $100 for, you know, four people to participate in a race is certainly a deal.
Yeah. So. Definitely. So since you brought up the bikes and the gear, so there's a specific type of bike, and I've seen some of them in bike shops, and I hate to bring up to bring up DePaz, because they try to do something kind of similar, but sometimes I'm in Terre Haute, I see some of those bikes come in. But can you talk about why those bikes are used and the history behind that? And I see on pictures that students are racing in like flat pedals and all, you know, I guess let's go into that.
Absolutely. So, like you said, our bikes are really unique, and there are races that other colleges do. For instance, I believe they end up on road bikes, and I believe they have multiple riders on the course, or like University of Evansville down south. They actually buy some of our old bikes for what they call bike race. So our bikes are, I really don't know the history as to why it was, let's do single speed and let's keep it this way. But for our race, it's very, very important to not have clips. Like I said, it's a big relay race. So one of the biggest skills and techniques that's unique to the Little 500 is being able to come in and press on that coaster brake and do an exchange. So you're passing that bike off to your next teammate. That would not be possible with clips.
Right. But first, we're going to take a quick moment to reminisce in a very iconic moment from the movie Breaking Away. Buongiorno. Come stai? Oggi è molto umido, non è vero? Va diavolo. Before before we dive back into our discussion with Emily Carrico, the race director of the Little 500, we're going to take a quick moment to talk to somebody else who brings in great information about a little bit of the history of the bicycle in the race. However, he's also going to talk a little bit about his volunteer work with coaching. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim. And have him talk more about the Little 500 from his perspective. And I have Jim Kirkham on the phone or on the call to talk about some more specific things on a coaching level, but also a little bit more about the history. So welcome, Jim. Really excited Hello. For you.
Yeah. Thank you, Margie, here. For having me.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce yourself and kind of give your background?
Sure. I'm from Indiana. I got involved in the Little 500 and bikes in general after my best friend. Went to IU a year ahead of me.
Okay.
And he kind of joined this bike team called the Cutters, and he was telling me how cool it was. So I decided I'm going to do that also. So yeah. I made my way to Indiana University. I got a road bike, started training, started learning about bikes. I just fell in love with it. Fell in love with riding my bike around Monroe County and all the areas around it. Exploring new neighborhoods, new towns. And I fell in love with Little 500 and the competition side of bikes. And just kind of stuck with it. That was back in the early 90s. Now here we are many years later. And I still just love bikes. I love helping kids get on bikes and teaching kids how to ride safely. And it's just a really fun thing. And I'm really glad I found it in life.
Yeah. Well, I'm really happy you're on this call because I think what we're going to talk about is going to be really great to tell the story of what's going on with the Little 500 to the state. So you're still in Bloomington? Is that correct?
Yeah, I live in Bloomington. I try to ride my bike 3 to 5 days a week.
Awesome.
So that's great.
Awesome. All right. So specifically about the history, I really want to kind of dig deep into the bike and why the specific type of bike. So let's first describe what type of bike do the kids ride?
Well, the Little 500 bike has changed many times over the years. In the 50s, when the race started, they used basically a beach cruiser.
Really?
Wide tires, coaster brake. A 46-18 gear, so 14th in the front, 18 in the back. And then they had drop bars on it. They put drop bars on it. Oh. And it was a heavy bike. It was a clunker bike. And over the years, the bike has mostly stayed the same. Manufacturers have come and gone. The bike used to be steel. Then it went to aluminum. Now it's back to steel. The geometry of the bike has changed over the years. The tire size has changed. But the most important thing is the gearing on the bike has stayed the same.
Right.
So it seems like an easy gear when you're just pedaling it around your neighborhood. But at race pace, over the course of 200 laps, the gear gets pretty hard and it gets pretty tiring.
Yeah. Right. So right now you kind of brought, up about the different types of bikes. So what you carry, is it Schwinn right now or no, it's state.
It's state bikes now. Yes.
Right. Right. And so it's a very specific type of bike. Is that to like level out the playing field or how does, I guess that's my specific question I want.
Yeah.
To know myself.
I think originally it was to create a low barrier of entry. Right. So everyone rode the same bike. And originally they probably just got them out of the box and rode them.
Right.
And with people's competitiveness eventually kicking in, teams start to figure out how to improve the bike when it comes out of the box and maybe grease the bearings or
right.
put a lighter set of, put maybe a lighter wheels on it or more comfortable saddle. So over the years it's kind of morphed a little bit.
Sure.
But essentially it's the same bike for everyone. So,
okay.
Keeps the cost down and makes the playing field equal for everyone.
Right. So I do want to talk a little bit because Emily and I talked about people that are on the team, because you have groups of four or teams of four, and there might be somebody that's taller, might be somebody that's shorter, and how, and it's like a strategic plan, mm-hmm. right, with the team of how to pick mm-hmm. the bike size. So how do you, as a rider yourself that participated, how does that work?
When I rode Little 500, it was common for, we only had one bike size to choose from. This is the early 90s. So we got there was men's bikes, and the women's race was pretty new. So we got one size bike, and you had to figure out how to fit on it.
Okay.
So if we had a tall guy and a short guy, the short guy would build up their shoes. Mm. So you'd get anywhere from 1 to 3 inches of extra insoles sure. put on your shoes to make you taller.
Yeah.
So you could reach the pedals. Or you wear a couple pair of chamois, so you got an extra inch there. And maybe a tall guy had to ride a lower saddle, so yeah. his quads might have burned a little bit. You just had to figure it out. These days, teams have gotten a little more creative, and they're willing to the university offers different size bikes, so you can get a large or a small, and you can find a bike that fits the riders better. And you can change the saddles during the race, so you can do wow. a certain kind of exchange where you don't use the same bike the whole race. So you can change the saddle height off and on during the event. So there's more creative ways to get around the different heights now.
Yeah, that sounds like a whole different game, right?
Different tactics are involved.
Definitely. So you are a coach, correct?
Yeah, I still coach the Cutter bike team.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about the name Cutter and the history? I watched the movie. I watched the movie finally.
Great.
So do you want to kind of talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. Yeah. The movie's wonderful. Right? They did a great job of showing Little 500, showing Bloomington. But most importantly, they captured that time of life when you're in college and how you're growing, you're changing, you're transforming.
Yeah.
Right. Which is really my favorite part of Little Five is you come to IU as a young person just leaving home. And you really have no clue who you are. And not to say 4 years later you do, but you're getting closer.
Yeah.
So within 4 years, you're learning how to take care of yourself more. You're getting a better idea of who you are, better idea how you can serve your community. You kind of know your strengths better. So breaking away is great for that. And I fell in love with that part as a coach. When I started coaching in the late 90s, I fell in love with that part.
Yeah.
Is watching kids grow, watching kids change. And then along the way, we won a lot of races, which is fun also. Like, it's a competitive event. So
yeah,
winning does matter when you're in competition. But it's more important to have fun and to allow yourself to develop and transform or through the race. And the race provides a great venue for growth.
Yeah.
And I love it about that.
Yeah. So when it comes to coaching, how do you want to give just a little bit, not in extreme detail, but what do you do to get the kids ready and train?
As everything changes over time, coaching also has changed. When I rode, it was a lot of like, here's the way you do it. Just go out and do it. Like, you know, there's only one way or the highway kind of mentality. Times are different. Training styles are different. Kids are different. So I have to kind of learn to kind of roll with that and allow kids to be different. There's so many books and podcasts and everything about training. So everyone's got a different idea how to train. Generally, if you ride your bike consistently, go hard a couple of days, go easy a couple of days, you're going to get better.
Yeah. Right?
And if you do some focused training around Little Five specifically, because we only have one gear, you have to learn how to pedal that gear faster.
Yeah. High cadence.
So you got to do well in Little Five, you have to be able to have some legs that can handle high cadence. So we do some specific training around that.
Yeah.
To get ready for that. And you got to learn how to do exchanges, which means you got to run and jump on the bike at high speed and jump off the bike at high speed. So you got to learn how to do that, train those things. But most kids who join the Cutter team are competitive by nature. They're ambitious by nature. So really it's getting them to ride their bike together consistently is generally enough.
Right.
Yeah. And specific training plans come and go. Every team's different. Every team has strengths. So that changes year to year what to focus on.
Yeah. Well, the first person I interviewed for this podcast long ago, I shouldn't say long ago, beginning of this year, was Bryce Fuzzy. I don't know if you know him, but he coaches as well. So how can somebody get involved? Do they need coaches or what?
You don't have to have a little five coach, but it helps to have somebody who's done it before to kind of, to help create a roadmap for you. So you know what not to do. So you don't make all the mistakes. Cause look, you only have 4 years to ride little five. And if you're just starting out, it's going to take you 3 years to figure it out.
Sure.
So then you only have 1 year left, then you graduate. Right. So it's better to, if you have somebody who's gone through it, they can help kind of point you in the right direction, let you make some mistakes, but then kind of teach you how to get better. I think a coach is good for that, for sure. Okay. Then on race day, it's just a big chaotic event. You know, you have 200 laps of all kinds of chaos going in.
Right.
So having some coach that might be able to kind of sit back and let the chaos play out and make a couple choices, a couple decisions will help out the team a lot.
I have two more questions. One of my questions is there anything else that you would like the state of Indiana to know about Little 500?
Yeah, I think, you know, bikes are great. And Little 500 takes a lot of kids and puts them on bikes. And it's hundreds every year of young adults that are getting exposed to bikes. And it's helping their mental health and their physical health. And these kids are going out and buying bikes, riding bikes, exploring their community on bikes. It's just a great introductory into exercise, fitness, lifestyle. And you can ride your bike, you know, all your life, up into your 80s or 90s, really, if you're safe. So the Little 500 does a great job of introducing that and helping keeping Indiana healthier. And over the years, Little 500 has gotten a reputation for mostly being a party.
Yeah.
You know, for various reasons. And it's a great time. But inside the arena, the kids that are racing and putting their time and effort into it, it's not a party. It's a real transformative event. And I don't think everyone in Indiana understands that, how serious the riders and athletes take it.
Yeah.
How meaningful it is to them in their life's journey. It's a lot more than just a party, a drunken party.
Well, now the state will know because this will be on the podcast. My last and final question is what is your favorite memory as a coach?
Oh boy. I've been doing this for a long time. I don't know, being at a wedding, a couple of weddings, watching people dance on the dance floor and standing back in the corner and seeing all these different generations of cutters on the dance floor, just having a fun time together. That's a great memory. It probably something along those lines.
Yeah. Do they have good dance moves? Is the
No,
bad.
They're terrible, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah, right. Well,
And there's memories of, you know, winning the race, but it's more the moments after the race, the friendships, the bonds.
Sure. Cycling is a great sport and a great sense of community. And I appreciate you going into some details about the Little 500 that I can add to Emily Carrico and I's discussion. So I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
And we're back talking with Emily Carrico, who is the race director for the Little 500 race at IU Bloomington. And let's dive back into the discussion. And then also, I was curious, this is just me looking at pictures. You obviously have a team of four women or four men, and every person is not the same size. So how do the students navigate that bike fit or that bike situation and passing on the bike? So how many bikes can you have per team, and how does that work with the sizing?
Yeah, that is such a point of strategy, I think, especially with those teams that are more tenured and more developed, is, oh my gosh, how do we fit, you know, these four riders onto these two bikes? And then also, typically our teams have kind of deeper rosters than just the four riders they have on race day. So they keep looking and trying to think. They typically pick up their bikes in, you know, early March, end of February. So they're kind of going, okay, who do we think might be on the team and who won't be, and how do we, you know, kind of best modify this? So for a while, those bikes came in two sizes. And Schwinn was our retailer for almost 20 years. And so then typically it was men's and women's bikes, just in general. And, you know, if you had someone that was very tall or very petite, you might ship, but generally that made it pretty easy. And then a couple of years ago, we shifted to State Bicycle Co. being our vendor, and expanded to having a 50 centimeter, 54 centimeter, and 58 centimeter frame. So that's really up the ante on strategically, what do we do? What do we pick?
Sure.
And teams back in the day had a lot of platform shoes that they would wear to try and, you know, make up that difference for the height of their riders. I mean, people have all kinds of fun little methods, but generally I think that you just try to find what is that happy medium for your riders. There's so much strategy that really goes into it. Some teams are like, we want to run the exact same thing on both bikes, no matter what, for our riders, because then if there's a crash, everyone's used to riding the same bike.
Right.
Some teams are happy to have two different sized bikes and swap out the different handlebars or swap out the seats every time their riders exchange and they have a bike with their mechanic. So it's complex. It's a very personal thing for teams.
Definitely. And the whole strategy, what you're saying is kind of figuring out and navigating that and trying to figure out what is going to be best for all the riders. So what are some things that students look for and ask for from maybe donors, or what kind of gear do they need for this event or this season of racing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as I said, you know, that learning curve in cycling is big, as everyone knows. So is that kind of gear and accumulating all of that gear, and then sponsorships to kind of, you know, help alleviate that. So the race itself, we have sponsorships, right? So this event really doesn't happen without private support. And so that's the kind of, you know, those funds allow us to do things like only charge $100 for that entry fee and subsidize the bikes that the teams get, and just be able to pay for all of those costs of the race, along with, you know, our teams trained year round. They have access to the track for months before the race. There's a lot that goes into it. So from the Student Foundation side, we do rely on private support to really make this happen. And then teams themselves, independent of the Student Foundation, can go out and get sponsorships. So I can say, like, when I was an undergraduate, you know, we would go and ask family and friends and, you know, local businesses and just try to get, you know, a few $1,000 together, and that would help fund kits, or if we went on a team trip, or, you know, the equipment that is kind of, you know, wear and tear, and, or things that you try to build up inventory for, maybe spare bike parts or something like that, over the years. So especially when our riders are starting, you know, anything and everything is really useful to them. We take donations all the time from teams or alumni or just people in the community that are like, hey, I have some, you know, hand-me-downs that I'm ready to get rid of. And then we have what we call a garage sale, but really it's just us laying out all these items.
A swap meet or
especially
something.
Our newer riders can just come in and take whatever is, you know, useful for them just for free. So
that's great. That's, I think I really like that for students to come in like a swap meet where they can just pick and choose what works for them. And if it works, it works. So right now, since we're at August, and this is an April event. Mm-hmm. Is this considered the off season, and what do you do, and what do you do to prepare for the 2025 season coming up?
So one of the, I think, biggest misnomers with the Little 500 is that it's only an April thing, and there's only stuff happening in April. And, you know, right after April, when it hits May, June, July, our students are out of town. That's really kind of our off season, though plenty of them are out training. But we kind of start planning, I mean, really before the next year is even concluded. So for myself and the three other people that I work with, we have this, you know, our tiny office, we are always kind of looking ahead, but we have events all throughout the fall and all throughout the spring. We have, see here, about 8 race days in the fall, and we do a whole variety of races at the track. We also do some on campus, like street sprints. They have a cycling cross event. So the fall keeps myself and our riders and students plenty busy with all of those opportunities, and our riders also help onboard some of those new riders that we call rookies and just help them get acclimated. So that kind of caps off our fall. Typically, once the weather starts changing, you know, in November, and then we have what we call rookie week in February, and that's when typically the bulk of our new riders come out on the track, start getting acclimated, learn how to do an exchange, learn how to get on the bike, all of those fun kind of niche skills. And then, you know, the weekend after they come back from spring break, that's qualifications. So only the top 33 teams are able to race in the Little 500. And they do that through qualifications, which kicks off our spring series. We have ITTs, missing out, team pursuit. So there's a lot happening that I feel like people don't even realize. Like, our riders definitely do not just show up in April and say, like,
right,
hey, I want to be on a team and get sure on the bike. They take this very seriously and do it year round.
Sure. No. And I had that written down, spring qualifications. So what is spring? What happens, I guess, during spring qualifications? Do they ride and do a race that their time is determined, you know, where they're going to be, if they're going to race in the Little 500 or not?
Wow, that's a great question. So qualifications consists of a team doing 4 laps as fast as they can. So each rider does 1 lap. And typically those times are around, you know, 2 minutes and 20 seconds, I'd say, is about the fastest gentleman's time in recent history. And then, you know, it's all under 3 minutes. So these teams are doing an exchange each lap. And it okay has to be within certain parameters. So they have a 32-foot section to really exchange this bike. They can't drop the bike. They can't lose possession of it. You know, just some of these rules that are a bit more strict than on race day. But, yeah, they're trying to get the top 33 fastest times in order to be able to participate in the race.
That's great. I remembered my question now. How many laps during the actual race does a rider ride? But does it, I guess my real question or first question is does a rider just keep riding and riding and riding until they get fatigued, or do they have like a cap, or is that just strategy within the team? Like, the strongest rider goes out and does as much as they can?
Yeah. So that is absolutely strategy based. And you know, each team kind of has their preference. So teams do have a minimum number of exchanges they have to do. So you okay can't just have one rider out on the bike doing the entire race. Women have to do 5 exchanges. Men have to do 10. And so making sure that they meet that minimum number of exchanges forces them to break down that race between the riders that they have. You know, they could compete with only 2 riders if they want. And sometimes that does happen. Typically, that's not, you know, typically something's not wrong and, you know, someone's injured or something
sure
like that.
Sure.
But it really depends. Some teams, they want to have their riders out there for 3, 4, 5 laps. Some of them want them out there for, you know, closer to 10 to 15. And then some riders end up doing these really large sets. I know there's a gentleman who did, you know, 46 laps.
Whoa.
Men's race. Yeah. Just consecutively last year. So it greatly depends on the team and kind of how strong sure they feel everyone is. And it really also depends on the pace of the race. And when you see teams go off the front that are really trying to win, they'll typically do only a few laps. And ITTing off the front, do 4 to 5 laps. But the goal there would be to keep your rider having that gap, you know, from the pack and hopefully growing that gap. But every time you do an exchange, you lose a couple seconds. So it really is finding that sweet spot of how do you keep your rider from getting too fatigued while you also don't do too many exchanges and lose time.
Sure. So I wrote this down because I'm a very visual person, and obviously we have people listening, and like even me, I've never been to one of your races. So with 33 teams that qualify to race in the official race, what does the race day look like? Are there 33 athletes on the course that all start at the same time, and then kind of people start falling off the groups and maybe get lapped? Like, what does the day look like? Is it chaos?
It can be organized chaos for sure.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I think that when you walk into Bill Armstrong Stadium on race day, it is filled with so much energy. We have pit boards everywhere. We have towers. We have medical tent. Like, everything is so colorful and so lively. If you come here on another day, it's typically not decorated like that. But there's all this energy, and we have 33 pits that really line kind of those stream bays.
Yeah.
So you see all the teams in their pits, and typically they have a trainer with a road bike, and that's where they're warming up.
So okay.
Those, they have a coach, a student coach, their mechanics on the infield, typically with their spare bike. And then, yeah, at any given time, 33 riders should be out on that track. And we have this very nice kind of procession at the start of it. I think some of what makes this race so fun is the pageantry that we have beforehand. So they do, you know, 3 grade laps, and they're organized in these, 11 rows of three. And it's just a really fun event to watch. But as soon as that green flag goes, typically the pace is hot. It picks up. Sometimes you have teams stick with that pack for a while. Sometimes they are, you know, falling off in the first 10 laps. It really just depends on the speed. And I would say the real organized chaos is once teams start to exchange. So they have a 16-foot wide pit. So if you can imagine, you know, these teams are in close proximity.
Oh, yeah.
They practice communicating with each other and trying to stagger their riders. So if, you know, 2 or 3 pits next to each other have exchanges coming in, and, you know, incoming and outgoing riders, just trying to make sure that they do that safely without colliding. So
let's back up again a little bit, because I have a bunch of different things I wrote down prior to our call that I wanted to ask you. And you kind of touched a little bit on it. But as students see that this is a potential opportunity for them to get involved with the events and the foundation and racing, and maybe even just start being on a bike. So you mentioned a manual, and I wanted a rider, you know, resource manual. Where can people find that, and how can people, I guess, start researching? Like, where can they go? I'm on your website, but I just see results and records and whatnot. But what's the best way for somebody to get involved?
So I think the easiest way for someone to get involved, honestly, is to go to our Instagram. We have an interest form that takes about 10 seconds to fill out, if that. And once someone clicks that they're interested in becoming a rider, we automatically put them on an email list and start reaching out and making connections with them, just trying to assist and help them, you know, kind of get familiar. So our manual is on our website. It's under students and then riders. And so we do have that as, like, for our new riders and our rookies. I think that can be really overwhelming to open up with 60 pages. So one of the best ways that I try to keep our students just privy to what's happening or to, you know, rules and regulations is I send out emails weekly, just trying to highlight upcoming dates and make it very clear, like, if you're a new rider, you need to attend this many skills clinics or, you know, Wilcox rides or whatever it is. But that kind of addresses the whole community. And then we have a group of student riders that are leaders called the Riders Council. And we have a group called Outreach that really focuses on those new members and making a connection with them and their teammates and just helping guide them through kind of like those initial first steps to just make them feel comfortable, make sure they're, you know, prepared and ready to go.
Sure. I went on your Instagram page so I can say this on the call so people can listen. So their Instagram is at IUSF Little 500. And then they also have a great Linktree link that's on their Instagram page, which is Linktree IU Little 500. And there's a bunch of links, like Emily just mentioned, about resources, how to join and get on that email list so that you can be part of the fun, which is really great. So with that, I know you mentioned this, the clinics and the training rides. Obviously, this is a very unique style of racing and riding. And actually, I just recorded a call with OVCX, which is a cyclocross organization, and talking about how intimidating sometimes if you're new to racing and how cycling can be very intimidating, especially if you show up and everyone's on these carbon bikes and they've got their sunglasses and their matching helmets, or they've got like team kits. So what do you do, and what do the other teams and maybe ride leaders do to help welcome? And you've mentioned this a little bit, but what are some great things that IU does to do that?
Well, I think one of the best things is, like I said, 95% of our students do not ride a bike in any kind of competitive way or own a road bike, really, before they joined the Little 500. And so knowing that, you know, their undergraduates normally around for 4 years, they're never more than, a couple of years away from having been a rookie and having had to learn all of that stuff themselves and just, you know, having to acclimate. So a lot of our riders, what that feels like. And they're just a very welcoming community. So I think that they're very big on encouraging, like, hey, it's okay. You know, here's what we need. We need you to have a helmet. And, you know, we need you to have a water bottle with you. And those are kind of our basics. And don't feel like you need to understand and know all of this immediately. Like, it's okay. We've all been there. It takes some time just to get acclimated. So some of those rides that we do for newer riders, those clinics, that really helps give those students an opportunity to bond with each other.
I sure
think that if you go through that process with someone else, even if they're not on your team, it really kind of strengthens that relationship. And then they're able, you know, to see each other at track practice or at events and really have that connection. Things that we do as the Student Foundation, we have road bikes that are free for students to check out all the time. So that's really nice because they can come in and try. We have about 15 different bikes right now. So especially if they're looking at getting a new bike or just wanting to try and see, is this for me? You know, mm-hmm. They can check that out, bring it back, try another bike, and just see how they feel about it. We also have about 80 Little 500 bikes in our bike shop up at the track. And so students come in, check those out all fall and spring, also free of charge. We maintain those for us. So we try to keep that commitment level kind of low. And then that way they can really focus maybe not so much on, you know, maintaining a single speed bike, but on being able to show up to practice or show up to rookie week and learn some of those skills.
Well, you heard it, Indiana. IU has incredible resources for their student athletes and students to get involved in biking, which is amazing and great. So that's incredible. So I have something written down, and I don't know if I'm going to try my best to word this, but sportsmanship. Obviously, it's a competitive sport. Cycling is. And I'm sure the adrenaline, being in that stadium and the pressure, right, to perform, but also potentially win this big event. Obviously there might be people that get upset that they don't win or they have mistakes that happen. I guess what are some of the ways that the students and teams and maybe even you address, you know, sportsmanship issues that might happen?
I think we're pretty fortunate because our students, it's so unique because they show up, right, and they compete and they are fierce competitors.
Yeah.
Not really like just when you show up to a weekend race, and like, maybe you'll see folks in the next weekend, maybe you won't, you know, they're really in this community together. So sure. They're going to be seeing these folks, you know, next week and at social events, and they yeah. spend a lot of time together. So I think that, while they are incredibly competitive, sometimes that camaraderie is strengthened just through the community that they have. Of course, as the, you know, group that puts this on, we want our students to have a great experience. And we do have guidelines in our manual just about, you know, yeah. sportsmanlike conduct. And we do expect our students to conduct themselves in a way that is sportsmanlike, but we also understand, you know, there is frustration when you don't, when you set a goal and you work towards it and it doesn't go how you, you know, how you wanted it to. But I can say, thankfully, I haven't had to, you know, pull our students aside and talk yeah. to them about this is how you behave and this is how you lose gracefully or win gracefully. Yeah. I think they're very, very aware of that. So yeah, we're also fortunate. We've had IU Athletics come over and give nutrition talks to our students.
That's great.
As a bonus, brought their sports psychologist over because, as we know, cycling is so mental. So I think that just some of those resources really, really help. And I mean, at the end of the day, this is the race that happens once a year, right? And there's 33 teams, but only one team wins. So the majority of our students don't win.
And I right, know that, right.
It's hard to say. Sometimes it's hard for them to hear, but, I think that there really is just this beauty in working so hard for this goal and sometimes not achieving it, and what you can learn about, like, well, why did I do this? Why did I train all these hours? And what did I get out of this experience that maybe like winning wouldn't have changed, or, you know, wouldn't have, sure. it wouldn't have like mattered. So I think a lot of our students really get through this. And even if they are disappointed in the outcome of race day, they look back and go, oh my gosh, but I wouldn't have grown in this way. I wouldn't have pushed myself. I would have gotten to meet all of my best friends. They get so much out of this. And for me, that's really one of the things that's best about this job and just the most rewarding, is seeing that growth in our students. And, you know, I would love for all of them to win, but I know that they get so much more out of it than just like that trophy and those bragging rights. So
definitely. I just recorded a podcast with Dylan Curtis, who started Apex Cycling. And I know that there are a fair amount of little 500 riders that are on his Apex team. But we talked about, I have a women's team here in Terre Haute, and a lot of us are just kind of middle-aged women just dabbling in racing and having fun. But one of my riders said to me, and I told this to Dylan on the call, you know, she told me that it gave her a way to belong to something. And to me, that's something that I think you're speaking about, with this whole little 500. And even if the student athletes or the team doesn't win, they're having a place to belong and be part of a community and be part of something that's great. So I really enjoy hearing those stories, because, it's really empowering and great impact on the community. So I want to talk about team jerseys. So I've been Googling pictures. I've been looking at Facebook, Instagram, everything like that. I've obviously seen lots of stuff online. How do teams design their jerseys? How do they pick their name? How do they even start the jersey process? I know some of them you said are fraternities and sororities, but what are some of the designs and things that students do to create something?
Yeah, so something I probably should have mentioned with qualifications is the placement of teams and qualifications that determines the order they get to pick their pit. There's a okay. lot of competitive advantages or strategies as to where you pit, who you pit next to, where it is on the track, right? And then they also get to pick their jersey. So, you know, our first place, they actually get the green jersey if they win qualifications. And then, you know, the second place team would then get to pick their pit and jersey second, and so on and so forth through those 33 teams. So the jerseys that you see our riders wearing on race day, those are actually through our partnership with Giordana, which we love working with them. They have these really, like, you know, high quality jerseys, and they're unique because they have the team name and sponsor on the front. They've got their qualification number on the back. They don't have any pockets. You know, we don't want folks accidentally bringing their cell phone on their bike or something during that race. So for race day in particular, you know, we actually provide them with those jerseys. And some teams go and get them tailored. Some teams have the whole fan section get decked out in those colors. It's really fun. And like I said, it's very, very colorful. So our teams, we have about 13 solid jerseys. So typically those teams that are more competitive, they generally want to get the solid jerseys. Those are the more coveted jerseys. And then the rest of the field, it kind of, you know, there isn't a huge hierarchy in terms of what colors teams go for. It's probably just their personal preference. Outside of IUSF, a lot of our teams do enjoy, you know, getting their custom jerseys and doing that through a variety of vendors. So when you talk about belonging, I think that is one of the things that especially, you know, when new riders get a team kit, they're like, oh my gosh, you're like, this is the best day. So yeah. They design those themselves. And it really depends on how their name comes about, if it is because they're affiliated with someone or if it's just something where they said, this sounds cool, let's go for it. It is fun to ask independent teams, especially like, so why did you guys pick that? Like, what spurred you to choose this name? They normally have a good story.
That's great. No, I think it's a great way to get kids involved and on bikes, and obviously they're having fun, right? Okay. So I'm looking at my list as I wrote things down. Let's see. I already asked what happens during a race. Okay. So I've noticed with some of the teams, and like I mentioned in a couple minutes ago about even like Apex Cycling has a lot of little 500 riders. I've seen some little 500 riders on elite gravel teams, some going on the road. What are some of the stories that you have witnessed maybe during your, two, 3 years of being in this position, or maybe ones that you saw in the past, of IU students that raced little 500 that went above and beyond and got maybe elite professional racing jobs or spots on teams?
It's a really interesting pipeline, partially because we don't allow CAT 1 and 2 riders to participate in our race. So this kind of throws back to, you know, the 70s and 80s. So Breakaway came out, it was very popular. Film gave this race a lot of notoriety, which is fantastic. It also brought, you know, some riders that were Olympians, or some teams were trying to bring in professionals who weren't really, were just there to race the little 500. They weren't necessarily there to be students. And so we really believe that they should, you know, our riders are students first. And this now sounds crazy, but these rules were put in place just to help protect this race. And now I think that's something where, oh my goodness, I do not see someone, you know, flying in a Cat 1 athlete and then paying tuition just to ride in the race. So I suppose the objective has been achieved, but there is just kind of that dynamic of, you know, some of these riders probably started having no riding experience. And then through the little 500, they've discovered, I love training. This is something that I can actually turn into a career, or this is something that I want to continue doing, you know, during the summer and even after my time at IU. So we do have some rules that help those riders, like if they started off as a Cat 5 with us and then they grew into being, you know, Cat 1 or 2, they're able to have 1 year of eligibility, so like their senior year typically, as a Cat 1 or 2. So that kind of helps them develop on the road, or Belgium or wherever it is. But yeah, we do have a lot of riders. I mean, there's decades worth that have come through, you know, Bloomington the Mall 500 and turned into, professional cyclists. One of them that comes to mind is Eric Young. He rode for the Cutters, graduated mostly 2011. But I'm actually from Bloomington, so I remember going to these races when I was, you know, little. There's time where that team is winning consistently. And so he's one that, you know, as soon as he could, he signed a contract. And then once he graduated, that was his full-time job.
That's awesome.
So we've had there's a woman who I was mentored by, Jen Holland, and she actually left IU after she won, I believe, her freshman sophomore year, and then left IU to go train for the Olympics because she just got so into it and so competitive that, you know, she moved and made that big change. So there's a lot of folks that have turned into a career. There's also just a lot of World 500 alumni or current riders that, you know, when you go to their races and the crits during the summer, you're bound to see them. And some of them are definitely your most competitive, will be up on the podium, or some have done it for years. And I feel like there are some of those instrumental people in the community, thinking of someone like Bree Clark-Kovac, and just how she's really involved. I mean, was racing for years and years, and now is really involved in the Divas group.
Yeah.
What's making that happen. So yeah, it's fantastic. It's a great network.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier in the call that you have the athletic department come in and talk about sports and nutrition, as well as, you said, the psychology department talking about kind of the mental side of it. So I have a couple of people that are like coaches, or, you know, they're kind of like a Bree Clark that have been racing for a while, and they just want to support a team and coach them how to, you know, ride. I think someone on our board, Sarah Larson, she is a coach as well for a team. So how does somebody, I mean, do they have to have coaches? And if you want to become a coach, what's the best route of doing that?
Yeah, so they actually do not have to have coaches. I think it is generally beneficial for teams to have like some resources, you know, have someone who has some cycling knowledge, but yet again, it really depends on kind of what level they're aiming to compete at. And I mean, one of the best things about this race is we have teams who train year-round like crazy, you know, and probably be D1 athletes. You know, and then we also have teams that they really want to pick up their bike in the spring and they want to participate in this race and enjoy it. And then the rest of the year, you know, they want to focus on other things. So I think it really depends kind of on that team and their culture. So that's one of the things where it is so individual. In terms of teams kind of connecting with coaches, frequently it is alumni. I would say that is one of the best ways, but it's also just a lot of word of mouth. And, you know, that's not something that the Student Foundation is really involved in terms of teams and matching them with coaches. Sometimes we're able to pass along some contact information and assist, but generally that's something teams kind of take on themselves and find someone who fits within kind of the culture they're looking for and the level of competitiveness.
Nice. So you mentioned breaking away. I'm actually have it on my screen right now because everyone on this call is going to be like, Margaret, come on, you're a Hoosier and you haven't watched Breaking Away. I know I need to rent it. I need to sit down and watch it. But can we talk about the importance of this movie? And by the way, Dennis Quaid is in it. Like what? But anyway, I actually have a buddy that was on another board that I was part of. But Kenny Green, if you're listening, Kenny Green, he was an extra in the movie is what he told me. And that's how I always remember Kenny Green. But can we talk about the movie? Have you watched it? I hope you've watched it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've certainly watched it. You know, like I said, I'm from Bloomington. I actually rode a bike prior to joining Global 500 when I was a student. So yeah, it's been something that I've been around. I'm close to the house that, you know, like that Breaking Away house, and, you know, and they are jumping in the quarries. Well, if you see it, you know what I'm talking about, but like, I grew up swimming in those quarries. This is so fun. So yeah, I mean, Breaking Away is for this race, you know, like I said, the 80s was huge. It made it just incredibly popular, and especially anyone who, you know, was around back then, they heard about this movie. And so it's one of those things that is really, really cool to have just, you know, brought up and, you know, people of all ages kind of know about this race just from that movie. They might not be fans of cycling, but I think my favorite part of that movie is, you know, when I first watched it and I was younger, to me, it really was like a cycling movie. It was about bikes, and that was great. I love bikes, so it fit right in with my interests. And then as I've gone back and watched it, I realized, like, you know, it's really this coming of age story, right? Yeah. Like that, what it is, it's, you know, these kids starting to move into adulthood and struggling with what does that mean and how does that fit in with myself and my friends, my family. And I think that's actually something that all of our students can really relate to. And to me, that's a large part of our race, right? Like, we have these students that are coming in and, not all of them are going to win this race. They're going to try, they're going to train, but throughout this, it's a way for them to figure out, who am I and how do I prioritize my time? What do I believe in? For me, it's a very all-encompassing film, and I love it. And there are plenty of people that are like, I was an extra and they didn't have enough folks to fill the stadium. So they moved us around to, the different sections when they were shooting. And some of the folks in that movie were actually, part of the student foundation. So
that's great.
Bill Armstrong, who really helped this race thrive. He speaks in it on the podium. And Dave Blaze, of course, who it's based off of, he still comes to every race. So it, just kind of helps, I think, cement this tradition. And
definitely. Well, I'm going to have to add it to my list. I've been saying it for years, but I will have to definitely add it to the list. So to reiterate, I said 75th. You said the 74th men's race is 2025 and the 37th women's race is in April. So I'm going to say that out loud again, go to their Instagram page, and check out their link tree. But, qualifications is March 29th of 2025. The 37th women's race is April 25th and the 74th men's race is April 26th. Am I missing any dates that you want to kind of say again on the call for our listeners?
No, I think those are just a few of the things that we do. So, go on our website, check out some of those dates, or go on our Instagram, or email us, DM us, whatever. We are always happy to talk, but we do things all year round. So don't feel like you have to wait until April to come out and see what our students are up to.
I think that's what I'm going to have to do, because you always pick the same weekend as Paris-Roubaix. And that's like my mecca of gravel racing that I like have to go to, because I love Michigan and I'm from Michigan. So I'm hoping to come down and maybe March 29th, at least come see the qualifications, because I definitely want to be part of this.
It's a fun event. You should definitely, it's very like spectator friendly. I think that's one of the best things about our stadium too, is it's not like when you're trying to watch a road race and you're like, I get to see them for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
It really helps kind of just make that more spectator friendly experience being in one place.
So my last and final question, I'll ask after this one too, if there's anything else you wanted to mention on the call, but what is your most memorable memory or your favorite memory in this position that you've witnessed? And I know that's kind of putting you on the spot, but do you have a favorite memory or two? Oh boy, she's thinking, everyone.
I mean, I love my job and I'm really, really lucky to get to come into work every day, and every day is different and exciting. And there's so many fun things that happen here that it really is hard to pare that down. I think one of my favorite moments, just thinking back to one of our student leaders, his team unfortunately didn't qualify for the race 1 year. And I mean, that was very, very hard for that team and just how much work they put in and, just what a heartbreaking time. But within a few weeks, he was able to get up and talk at an end of year banquet and make a joke about it and just, have his head held high. And I think for me, that was, it's just great to see that growth. Like, when you work with those students and you see them go through these things that are really challenging and you really feel for them, but to see them kind of like come out the other side and be able to just grow and change as people, those are kind of things that I live for. Also just race weekend. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like I get to go up and be in the press box and help with their timing system. And just when teams, make certain moves and are exciting. So it is hard to compare to that.
Nice. So is there anything else right now that you can think of that we missed? I know I had a very long list of questions and things.
I love it. You dug into everything.
I did. I try to do my homework to make sure I fill the time and get as many resources as I can. Is there anything else you can think of, Emily?
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I know this is a cycling podcast.
No, go for it.
Is this fantastic tradition? And I think that's something that sometimes people don't know when they show up to our race is, of course, our riders train really hard. We have student leaders that assist with that and the learning. We also have a whole other side of the IU Student Foundation that assists just with putting on these races. This is something that students do a lot of. They're writing that script. The announcer is reading. They are helping set up these teams. They're helping run the qualification events. Like, there is so much work and so much, just so many impressive things that our students do that are behind the scenes. So I always like to talk about, our volunteers that, are not cyclists, and they really don't, they don't have interest in riding a bike normally, but they put in hours to make this happen. And I think that it's easy to relate to that, that growth in this athletic sense. So their story doesn't get told as much, but they are just integral to why this race happens and are so impressive and, don't really get all the glory when it's over.
So I guess I have one more question. I know you're like, oh, another question. What would be your biggest, advice and tips to give to a student that wants to get involved, whether it's with Little 500 or the other events that you put on?
I mean, just show up. Just show up to an event or DM us on Instagram. Just, kind of put that first step forward, because I promise we will meet you wherever you are. We are
right.
Responding to students, making sure that they've got someone to talk to, hang out with. Like, we really just try to immerse students and make them feel part of the community.
Sure.
Just as quickly as possible. And it's a ton of fun. I mean, the people that come through here, they end up in each other's weddings. They remember this years, like our alumni come back. I get calls and emails almost every week from someone like, hey, I rode in 1950 something and I just checking in on this, or I just wanted to say that I appreciated this last year. Like, we hear from our alumni all the time. So I say just show up to something, and I promise you won't regret it, but you will love just, becoming part of this community and getting that sense of belonging.
That's great. No, I really appreciate this discussion and one, you answering all my wonderful questions. but yeah, everyone check out Little 500. Check them out on Instagram, as well as they've got a website. I'll drop some information into the description of the podcast. But I think that's really all I've got today, and I'll edit this and hopefully get it out. There's probably like two or three podcasts ahead of you. But I, again, really appreciate you joining this call, Emily, and I look forward to seeing you hopefully at qualifications in 2025.
I'm excited. Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
All right, have a great day.
Bonjour, Papa!
Hey, thanks for tuning in. We hope you really enjoyed this podcast. For more information about our organization and other future podcasts, visit www.bicycleindiana.org. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you have a really great day.